The Spectator magazine combines incisive political analysis with books and arts reviews of unrivaled authority. Subscribe today for just £12 and receive a 12-week subscription in print and online. Plus, we'll give you a £20 Amazon gift voucher, absolutely free. Go to spectator.co.uk/voucher.
Hello and welcome to Coffee House Shots. I'm James Heal and I'm joined today by The Spectator's political editor Katie Balls and Paul Goodman, the former editor of Conservative Home. Now, Katie, since we last did this podcast, there's been a bit of a mini shuffle, five changes within government, two new deputy chairs. Talk us through them.
Yes, so this was sparked by the resignation of two ministers. They're not in some ways dramatic resignations because they are tied to the fact that MPs are stepping down in the next election. So one was James Heapy, the defence minister, who signalled a few weeks ago that he was planning to step down as an MP and step down as a minister when the time was right. At the time, he did not lean into reports that this was down to frustrations with Number 10 and Rishi Sunak over not pledging enough on defence. But I think the fact he used the dispatch box final appearance to talk about the need for greater spending does add some weight to that. And I think it's quite clear from his time working under Ben Wallace, both of them are pretty aligned as figures in the MOD on the fact you need to get to 2.5, potentially 3% eventually. Then you had Rob Halfin, Minister in the Department of Education, who was also to step down and therefore is stepping down from his role now. And it meant that there are various vacancies created. Just to run through them, you had Nusgani, who is now Minister of State in the Foreign Office, also facing sanctions, but she has had that promotion, which I think is probably the government sending a message. You have Leo Doherty, who's been appointed Minister of State in the Ministry of Defence, so replacing James Heapy. Kevin Hollenrake, a Rishi Sunak loyalist, who's been promoted to Minister of State in the Department of Business and Trade. Luke Hall is now Minister of State in the Department for Education. Alan Mack has been appointed Parliamentary Undersecretary of State in the Department for Business and Trade and the Cabinet Office. But I think perhaps the more striking politically of the appointments relates to the two new deputy chairs. Now, Rishi Sunak has not had great luck with his deputy chairs. Lee Anderson was a deputy chair. It was meant to be, you know, this answer to uniting the red wall and the blue wall by having Lee Anderson there. And at the time, Greg Hands was Tory chairman. Obviously, it's now Richard Holden who's Tory chairman. Lee Anderson resigned from that role over Rwanda. Obviously, Lee Anderson then lost the whip for a different situation and is now a reform MP. And I think that you can see in the appointment, which was Jonathan Gullis, the MP for Stoke-on-Trent North, being made deputy chair, alongside Angela Richardson, who is a Guildhall MP, you see again that attempt to do blue wall, red wall, and have those different angles to it. And I think she is very much a Rishi Sunak loyalist. What I think is interesting about appointing Jonathan Gullis is he is not a Rishi Sunak loyalist. He is someone who has at least spoken about rebelling against the government multiple times. He's been quite critical. He was one of around 20 MPs who voted against the Windsor framework under Rishi Sunak. So I don't think you can say he, you know, he's someone who's always made Rishi Sunak's life easy. He has of late been writing on WhatsApp groups about how we should have no more talk about leadership contests and all get behind. So I think in part what Number 10 are trying to do is by having a member of the 2019 intake from the so-called Red Wall, showing there's still that connection, trying to answer for the departure of Lee Anderson from not just a role, but the party. And then I also think if you're, to me, it strikes a little bit as Number 10 being on the defensive and trying to play things in a defensive setting and shore up Rishi Sunak. Because I think if you get to the heat of the local elections, Jonathan Gullis is the type of person who right now is saying a leadership challenge is an awful thing. But we've seen the number of times he's jumped on causes or turned against the government. Maybe by having someone like him in a role who could be prone to siding with someone the right of the party, you're making Rishi Sunak have a bit more potential support should difficulties come, which I think are inevitable.
Paul, what do you make of all the changes then?
I suppose the first commonality to look at is the seats that Rob Halfin and James Heapy were occupying, because although both were won pretty comfortably at the last election, and Harlow's been a Conservative seat since 2010, I mean, at the moment, frankly, neither of them looked like being held. So if you were Heapy, who came in 2015, or Halford, who came in 2010, and therefore now is a real long marcher by the standards of today's parliaments, why not go while the going is relatively good, and look forward to life outside. So I think that's the sort of biggest factor that has set all things off. As for Heapian defence, I mean, show me a defence minister who's not going to say now that defence should have a bigger spending than is baked into the accounts. They all think so. It would be a remarkable thing to find a minister who doesn't. So that's the setting. And really, once you're in the kind of downward spiral that the government appears to be in at the moment, getting it to reverse itself is very difficult. You have to sort of cast around to find ministerial replacements, and you have to take a few risks. And as Katie pointed out, Jonathan Gullis may be a Lee Anderson type risk, given he's gone one way and then gone another. And we wait to see generally what will happen now in the aftermath of these local elections.
The story that Labour's very keen to talk about today, Katie, is the fact that there's now record dissatisfaction recorded with the NHS. Just 23% satisfaction levels compared to 70% in 2010. Isn't this really indicative, I think, of the wider story and the problem facing the Conservatives, which is that, frankly, after 14 years, very few people in polls say in focus groups that they're happy with the state of public sector services under the Conservatives?
Well, it's clearly a problem that people feel as though their taxes are very high, post-war high, to be exact, and yet they don't feel as though they're getting public services to reflect that. And that is one of the big issues you're going to have in terms of the Tories trying to turn things around more than any change of leader or so forth. I think what's interesting about this is there a change in how people are viewing the NHS, or is the general sense still that just pouring money into it is the answer? Now, you look at what Wes Streeting is doing, talking about working with the private sector, talking about you know, hard truths to the NHS. I mean, I think there are very few people who think the NHS is more worried about a Labour government than a Tory one, no matter how tough Wes Streeting's talk is about reform in the NHS. But I do wonder if we're potentially heading to sea change where, for example, I've spoken to Tory MPs to merge us of our previous defence discussion, who felt as though Jeremy Hunt announcing a boost for NHS spending in the spring budget was a worse idea than having announced a spending increase for defence. And there's almost, I think if you look at the number now using, for example, private doctors has massively gone up and all those, and the sense of just exasperation that you cannot get an appointment. Perhaps we're moving to the point where it's not just pouring money in that's necessarily going to fix it. And I think it's just general disillusionment, which I think reflects badly on the government, to be very clear. But it does feel, I think, you get to a certain level of unhappiness and people start to think there isn't actually an easy fix to making this work.
Yeah, I mean, Paul, isn't there perhaps a sense as well that the 2010 Parliament was elected on a big agenda of public sector reform? There were things that went on, for instance, with education, universal credit. And then perhaps over the sort of past 14 years, the Conservatives have been a bit buffeted off the course of events because you had Brexit, you know, the energy, and went into that for sort of 3-4 years, and then COVID as well. Do you think that's part of the challenge, really trying to come up with a kind of reform agenda, as Katie says, in fiscally tight times, when, of course, you've had been in government for so long?
It's a huge part of the challenge. I mean, the Cameron government, the coalition government, was very keen on public service reform. My reading of it is that Theresa May wasn't so much, and Boris Johnson did have a bold housing plan that didn't come into being, but basically the Johnson philosophy about the public services was just pour more public money into them. And that would be difficult enough anyway if we were not facing the shock effects of the worst pandemic in 100 years, plus the first war between two major European powers in modern times. And these two enormous kind of shockwaves that have had global effects. So I thought for quite a long time that no one really owns, neither of the political parties own the education system, because education reform is a kind of sort of, has been a product over the years of both governments, going all the way back to Rab Butler and the wartime coalition. But Labour still, despite the sort of falling off in its reputation, is seen as the party that owns the NHS in some way. And I've always thought fundamental reform is only really going to happen under, one, a Labour government, two, in straitened financial times. Funnily enough, that looks as though those are the circumstances we're heading towards.
And I think that if you look at, for example, the Tory manifesto discussions, and there are five ministers working on the briefs. Oliver Dowden's in charge of public services, or at least the reach out to MPs on that. I think there is a sense that there has to be a reform agenda there because of the state of things. But to Paul's point, I think there is also a feeling when you speak to MPs privately and figures in, you know, senior in the Tory party, which is, it is one of those things which is probably easier might be the wrong word in some ways, but is more palatable politically for the Labour Party to do. Then as soon as the Tories talk a little bit about reforming the NHS or use the P word of privatisation, they do fall prey to these attacks that they want a US-style system, and then lots of the debate becomes that, as opposed to, I think, if it's a conversation coming from someone like Wes Streeting or a Labour figure, where I think there's just more benefit of doubt. And to your point about, you know, what does this mean for the election, or what does this mean for the Tories' prospects? I think it's an interesting stat, you know, which is just 24% of people said they were satisfied with the NHS in 2023, and that's fallen from 29% the previous year. But the lowest satisfaction level before that was 34% in 1997. And then what happened? Labour landslide. So I think unhappiness at NHS is clearly something that the governing party will be punished for, and does again, not that it seems very unlikely right now, but does increase further the likelihood of a fairly substantial Labour win.
Thank you, Paul. Thank you, Katie. And thank you for listening to Coffee House Shots.